Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to the PR Weekly, the podcast that gives you your weekly fix of PR industry news, analysis, and gossip. I'm Arvin Hickman, news editor of PR Week, and I'm joined by
John Harrington, PR Week UK editor.
Today, we're going to take a look at how agencies have performed in the past year. Our annual Top 150 has dropped, and we have all the insights that you need to know. Also, there's been a major acquisition involving one of the hottest creative comms shops in the UK. And a bit later on, we'll take a look at the fallout of the controversial Super League proposal. We'll be joined by PR Week EMEA Editor-in-Chief Danny Rogers for his take on the Top 150, what it all means, and also, being a very hardened Chelsea supporter, his views on the Super League saga.
I can't see any way a lot of these owners are going to be unseated from running these clubs.
John, how's your week been?
Busy, Arvind, yeah. I mean, the Top 150 is our biggest project of the year, and it takes up a lot of time, a lot of effort. Thankfully, it's very well received, and it's very nice to get it out there. So it's been pretty hectic, and especially with other stories going on in the background, as you mentioned, not least football.
Exactly. What have been some of the behind-the-scenes sort of headaches that people, you know, who read our stuff don't really understand?
Well, you've got to kind of, there are so many details involved in something like the Top 150, you know, down to sort of, oh, actually, could we change our name slightly from what you have listed to, oh, I didn't get the form, or I thought that by that you meant that, and all of these things. And, you know, usually there's sort of, potentially blame on both sides. Sometimes it's their fault, sometimes occasionally it's our fault. We do have to sort of deal with this, and it's lovely to see kind of everyone sort of posting about where they are on the list and celebrating it, which is brilliant. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and unfortunately does so once it's published. So I can't say I like this week, but I'm glad to have completed it anyway.
Exactly. I mean, it's one of those massive weeks for us, but, you know, we're all so happy when it's done and dusted. And in this week's news, Publicis Group has acquired the award-winning creative PR agency Taylor Herring for an undisclosed fee. Samsung and former Facebook comms director Anoushka Rouen has joined Soho House. Number 10 has hired Jack Doyle as its new director of comms, replacing James Slack. PR and sports marketing professionals have slammed comms around plans for a breakaway Super League in football. the PR industry has suffered its first aggregate decline in revenues in the past two decades, according to PR Week's Top 150. If you'd like to find out more about Top 150 and other news this week, please visit prweek.com/UK. In this week's deep dive, PR Week reveals the top 150 PR agencies in the UK, and it's fair to say 2020 has been a year like no other. Some of our listeners might recall the bloodbath that preceded the global financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, but this feels another level worse. Some of the headline stats: the aggregate revenue earned by the top 150 agencies in 2020 was down by 4.3% to £1.36 billion. Now, in 2019, it grew by 7.6%. 85 of the top 150 had revenue drops. Yet again, comparing to 2019, it was only 24. But amid all of the doom and gloom of 2020, arrives some glimmers of sunshine for 2021. John, what does this research tell us? It shows that 2020 was quite a brutal year, but there is still a lot of optimism for the year ahead.
Yes, there is. I mean, as you say, the headline numbers are brutal if you look at it and you compare it to previous years. As you say, aggregate revenue down 4.3%. It's been growing at high or low double digits for several years, actually. And, you know, we've heard several things about this. A lot of people have said the taps turned off in terms of client spending, particularly in the second quarter. Consumer comms was generally affected the hardest, as well as those agencies and industries most heavily hit by COVID directly, such as travel and hospitality. But it's worth saying the decline wasn't universal, actually. Some agencies saw very decent growth last year, and areas such as crisis, corporate, public affairs, ESG and healthcare, many agencies saw growth in these areas, sometimes quite strong growth, particularly agencies with some kind of international presence. And even among consumer, you know, that there were quite a few consumer agencies that performed comparatively well across the year, particularly some of the smaller ones. And in consumer, there's been a lot of talk about recovery from, you know, perhaps as early as late summer and certainly into the autumn. And a lot of them say they've had a really bumper start to 2021 with a lot of pitches going on. And a few agencies actually have said to me they expect their financial years to be flat or in growth. So I think this is the sort of context where we can get an idea of why there is quite a lot of optimism. We asked the agency bosses how confident they are about 2021 being a strong year of trading. And almost all were either moderately or very confident.
Obviously, compared to the last year, anybody would be optimistic. I mean, how much of that is genuine optimism?
No, it is. I mean, this is a question, and it's worth picking up on that specifically. We weren't asking people, do you expect 2021 to be a stronger year of trading? We asked them if we think it will be a strong year of trading. So I think the fact that there is such overwhelming positivity about that, I mean, part of me thinks this is kind of an optimistic industry generally. And it is an industry that by its nature, it likes to talk things up and be enthusiastic and kind of look on the bright side. But I also think it's based on the fact that so many are finding that, you know, if they've got this far, they've used furlough, they haven't necessarily had massive redundancies, although, you know, that quite a few agencies did make redundancies. A lot of them are hiring again. A lot of them are saying it's among the busiest periods for pitching that they've known. And a lot of pitching is going towards earned media. So actually, I think a lot of the groundwork for this is what we've seen in recent years, where kind of PR agencies have really started to eat into other markets, you know, taking some of the market that might otherwise have gone to marketing ad agencies, and also doing more of the consultancy work that may have gone to other organisations. So I think that although, as you say, it was very downbeat in 2020, that was a snapshot. You know, that was a period in time. And I think, in a way, we've got to look at it carefully, but we also shouldn't be too hung up on individual performances. I mean, there's a point I'm quite keen to make on this that I think is worth bringing out, that, you know, the top 150 this year, it was really noticeable, the sheer range of performances. I've compared it to previous years, and we've got a graph in our overview article that compares the kind of ranges of growth and decline among agencies in 2019 and 2020, i.e. how many experienced growth up to 5%, declined from 15 to 20% or whatever. I know that sounds a bit complicated, but the basic message is there was far more spread of performance in 2020. You know, in a way, 2020 feels kind of like the year of no normal. It was such a unique situation that although, yeah, we can track trends that we've mentioned before, like the growth in public affairs, the importance of corporate comms, crisis and all the rest of it. But I think in a way that can only go so far because there was a situation that won't be replicated in that form again, even if COVID is around for quite a lot longer, which we hope it won't be. So it feels like there's a lot to glean from it. But I really think that if you're one of those agencies that did perform badly, I almost wouldn't feel too downhearted about it. I mean, it was such a unique situation. And I think that if you're putting efforts in place to remedy the problems and if you sort of identified them, and let's face it, by this time, a lot of agencies have done that, or at least they know how they're going to do it. They've got some decent plans in place. I really think 2020 should be seen as a snapshot of a really hard period, but one that's behind us. And I think that is where a lot of the optimism comes from. I think it feels like we finished the marathon and it was really hard and we've got bruised ankles and we've got aching bones, but I feel we've also got the runner's high, and I feel that there is a bit of a positive trajectory at the moment, if I'm not mixing my metaphors too much.
But looking back at 2020, I mean, obviously, you know, it didn't affect everyone in the same way. The point that you made before, which parts of the comms industry tended to perform better than others?
Well, I think it was a lot of those that, it was a number of things. I mean, generally, if you're involved in sort of top level corporate and crisis, there was an opportunity there because frankly, all comms was crisis comms to some extent last year.
Would you say those particular consultants had a good year?
Well, a lot of them did. I mean, good is obviously a difficult term to talk about anyone's year during the pandemic, but in terms of trading, they did. And, you know, we saw some agencies grow organic revenue by 20, 25, 30%. And in one case, I think the highest was 58%, which is a healthcare life sciences agency, which I appreciate is a very specific area. But nevertheless, there was some sort of, if you like, generalist corporate bit of consumer sort of agencies that did very well. And I think some of them have said they benefit from having an international base. That means, you know, clients have been wanting that kind of help across borders, because obviously this is a truly global problem. And for global agencies, they want that sort of focused approach. So, yeah. And then also a lot of healthcare agencies, those that are involved in the vaccine and other healthcare issues, have obviously been in demand. There was more public sector spending with, you know, government and local authority campaigns and so on.
You're seeing a lot of agencies investing in that specialism and a lot of groups investing more in acquiring that healthcare specialism because of what's gone on in the past year.
Definitely. Well, it was a strange situation where we had a lot of people on furlough, quite a few people unfortunately made redundant. And I think a lot of very skilled people came into the jobs market around the summer. And I think quite a few agencies saw this as an opportunity, actually, to really kind of bulk up their specialisms. So I really think that was a factor. And you notice that with healthcare, for quite a few of the big kind of integrated agencies, the top 20 agencies, the kind of the strong performance of healthcare did help to mitigate the overall decline, or the sort of at best flat kind of revenue that they saw. So, you know, it was clearly a boost. Not, I say, it wasn't universal. I mean, not everyone, even in healthcare, did really well. And this is where I go back to that point about the no normal. I mean, part of the funny thing, an almost contradictory thing about this is we're talking about generalizations, right? But in a way, this is the worst year for generalizations, although we're giving them and they do stand, because there's for every statement I make like this, you could always say, yeah, but, or yeah, and. But nevertheless, there were certainly opportunities, and there are certainly some parts of the industry doing reasonably well.
So what else can you tell us about the report? What are some of the other key findings?
We can look at issues like rents. Some of the highlights, I mean, I don't want to give too much away until we've reported it, but there were some really interesting findings about rents, actually. We got some statistics about how many agencies have seen their rents go down, and also some comments about what different agencies have found with their rental situation. We've got some interesting information about furlough, how many agencies use that. And And also, it seems to me that, you know, a lot of agencies did use it, as you'd be unsurprised to hear. But I think it's fair to say there wasn't absolutely massive wide-scale redundancies. I don't want to underplay that because, you know, all redundancies are extremely difficult. And, you know, a lot of agencies did have some redundancies, did make some. But it strikes me that this is an industry where furlough was used to probably stave off some of that, at least for a time. So there's some of the big things. We're talking about the sort of challenges, biggest challenges. I mean, unsurprisingly, things like recruitment were significant, pressure on fees, client retention, and things like that. What was less significant was Brexit, actually. There's generally a sense that the impact of that hasn't been felt so far to much of an extent, although quite a few agencies are anxious about the future. And I would imagine that's something that is going to be a bane for quite a lot of agencies for a while.
Do you reckon that's partly because, you know, there's been much bigger problems like the pandemic?
Yeah, I do think that. Yeah, I think that has just overshadowed so many things, frankly. And I think, again, I mean, there is also the argument that if you're an agency that if your clients were directly affected by Brexit in the same way if they were directly affected by COVID, it's almost more need for good corporate comms, for good crisis comms, for good public affairs. So, you know, there is also that argument that if you're representing, say, the seafood industry, for example, the fishing industry, then, you know, maybe there are opportunities there because that's one sector that's had a really bad time. Yeah, it's a mixed picture, but there are certainly concerns about that. Those concerns haven't gone away, but I think there's a general sense that for most, it's been broadly neutral.
What would be your final sort of words to the industry, something looking ahead?
Well, I think that it's important to put last year in context, that it was a unique year, that we're in a situation where a lot of the industry have got their sights set on growth and they're optimistic and they've had a lot of several months now of quite a lot of opportunities in terms of new pitches, new business, and new hires and restructures and so on. So I think the industry should have reason to be, I know it's a cliche, but cautiously optimistic.
Fantastic. John, thanks so much for joining us this week. And listeners, if you'd like to know more about our Top 150, please visit our website, prweek.com/UK. All of our coverage is there. Joining us on the PR Weekly is PR Week's EMEA Editor-in-Chief, Danny Rogers. Danny, you've been analysing the industry for a long time now. What were some of your main takeaways from this year's Top 150 report?
Hey, Arvind. I've been in and around PR Week for the best part of two decades now for my sins. So possibly add a little bit of perspective to some of the things that John was saying earlier. Yes, it's amazing, really, isn't it? It's the first time in two decades that we've seen an aggregate fall in revenue from the top 150 agencies. It's really, really quite amazing. And to some extent, I think that's a sign of a mature industry in that at least we got the transparency from the agencies. Pretty much every UK agency gave us their revenue figures, despite it being a pretty poor year for a lot of people. So I'm so proud of the industry for practicing transparency, providing the figures, even though in some cases they were not great. And the amazing thing is that since the last recession, which probably peaked in 2009, the industry is about 50 or 60% bigger. So despite the 4.3% decline, it's now a £1.4 billion industry, which just goes to show what a mature contributor to the British economy it is.
I was going to ask you, Danny, it's a really interesting point you made. How bad was it in the last recession when the GFC happened? How much of a hit did the industry take then, and how would you compare it to this?
It's a very interesting question. From my memory of 2009, this recession is worse. Although that was a more of an economic recession rather than a short, sharp shock that we had with the pandemic.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Our top 150 back in 2009 showed actually just slightly less than 1% growth on aggregate. But I do think that a lot of agencies just didn't enter in 2009. So maybe that figure was a bit skewed. So possibly the last year's worse than 2009, but it's difficult to tell.
Sure. When the GFC happened and you like monitoring the fallout, are there anything with the pandemic that really sticks out as being more challenging than the time that agencies had post-GFC?
I think this past year, this past recession, has been completely unique in that business almost stopped for a quarter, didn't it, in 2020. You know, people just stopped being paid and stopped operating for a while. It was such a shock to the system. It makes it almost totally unique type of situation. Whereas in the last recession, it was a more gradual decline. So I don't think there'll ever be a year. Hoping never be another year like 2020.
What are some of the things they're now saying to you? What is some of the sentiment that you're hearing?
I think 2021 is going to be a very exciting year for the PR industry. I think particularly in social purpose, with the big climate conference coming up in November, there's a lot of focus on sustainability, on ESG, on corporate purpose. And that seems to me where a lot of the growth is going to come from. In terms of the challenges for the industry, I do think there's this big conversation to be had about working arrangements, whether or not they expect all their employees to get back in the office, how much willingness there'll be for employees to come back to big cities and go back into offices. There's a sort of renegotiation between employer and employees.
I mean, that's something that we're kind of like grappling with at Haymarket as well. How do you think the industry will handle this? Do you think there's going to be a lot more flexibility? Do you think most agencies are going to downscale and perhaps shift offices?
Almost every PR business is rethinking its office at the moment. The good news for the PR industry is that most of those firms were already reasonably flexible. You know, I think PR and media has been a more progressive employment place than some, say, finance sector. And every company is going to come to its own conclusions over this. But I've got quite a lot of confidence that the sort of people who work in PR, the sort of employers, are progressive enough to be flexible.
Anything else from the 2020 Top 150 report that really stood out for you? What are some of the key takeaways that sort of, you know, made you really think?
I think while healthcare PR has been growing for a number of years, it was the sector that really got the biggest boost during the pandemic, perhaps unsurprisingly. But also corporate, public affairs, crisis, you know, these areas that perhaps 10 years ago were being somewhat deprioritized in favor of consumer PR. I've had this great renaissance. So now everybody's talking about corporate reputation again as the big growth area. That seemed to define 2020 for me.
And do you reckon, I mean, looking ahead, how does corporate reputation and healthcare and these other areas look going ahead?
I think corporate reputation looks very interesting going ahead. I think the whole debate about ethical purpose has really moved on. And we now talk about ESG as a hygiene factor. You know, every company has to be walking the walk as well as talking the talk on ethics. And I don't think there's any going back on that. So if you're not a firm that's thinking carefully about corporate reputation and where ethical performance fits into that, you're not really going to be part of the top table anymore.
What about consumer PR? Because I hear from a lot of agency bosses, a lot of consumer PR agencies, that they're now starting to get the sort of briefs, much broader briefs, the sort of briefs that ad agencies might have had previously. It feels like they're encroaching into their space. Do you sort of see that as well?
Yes, for a long time we've talked about PR eating ad agencies' lunch. And I do think that often happens in a recession because earned media does tend to be more credible and it tends to be more cost effective than paid media. And the great thing about consumer PR in the last 10 or 20 years, it's become so much more genuinely creative. So it really is a viable alternative to advertising when it comes to getting brand messages across. So I do think consumer PR is in a good place as well. It's just that because it lives off marketing budgets, it's felt a little bit subdued over the past year.
On that note, now I have to mention this, and I know I mentioned it in the news roundup. Taylor Herring going to MSL. What can you tell us about that?
Taylor Herring being purchased by Publicis is an enormous story. I mean, Taylor Herring was one of the most famous boutique agencies, one of the most creative consumer PR agencies for the past 20 years. And now it's joining the Publicis Group, which hasn't always had the most creative reputation when it comes to PR and earned media. And I think this is why Publicis is buying Taylor Herring. In terms of why Taylor Herring is prepared to sell at the moment, I would guess that it's looking to scale. I mean, although Taylor Herring is a very well-respected and highly creative agency, it's only 2, 3, 4 million over the years. And this may well be an opportunity to really scale things up with the power of the Publicis network. So it'd be fascinating to watch what happens over the next 3 or 4 years, which presumably is the earn-out period for those agencies.
Did you ever get a sense from James or was it Kath, whether they were looking to sell, whether this was on the cards?
No, I never got the impression. Knowing James quite well and Kath and Pete Mount-Stevens, the other partner there, I didn't get an impression that they were keen to sell at all. Although I guess I've sensed a frustration over the years that they haven't been bigger. Despite all the accolades they get and all the great client work they've done, they're still not a big agency, not even a mid-sized agency in PR Week's rankings. So I guess it's not that much of a surprise, but I certainly never heard of them looking to sell.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, it definitely shocks me, but I mean, it's a very, very interesting acquisition and we'll definitely look on with that with great interest. Now, Danny, I wanted to talk to you about the Super League. A lot has changed in the past couple of days, in the past day, actually. Now, you know, you're a hardcore Chelsea supporter and you know, I support Liverpool. To begin with, just give us your impressions of how this has played out from your perspective.
Yeah, it's been an amazing story. It's been an amazing week as a football fan and as a business journalist, as we both are. And I don't think I've ever seen such a big story in a way come and go so quickly, in that this only broke on Sunday and here we are in the middle of the following week and it's all unraveled so quickly. It seems to me a completely poorly conceived project from the beginning. And I do think the communications from those within the ESL, whatever the ESL is or could have been, has been very poor. And the communication from the football clubs themselves hasn't been brilliant, has it? In terms of nobody's covered themselves in glory from the big six clubs or indeed anyone who's joined the ESL project.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, being a Liverpool supporter, it's been very, very difficult to sort of watch this because as I'm sure you have your own experiences with your own football club, but you sort of grow up and you have these ideals about what your club is and what it stands for and all these things. And all of a sudden, all of that just goes, it gets thrown out of the door. The owners who are billionaire American owners, in your case, Russian, don't really give a shit about your club ethos. And they basically take you on this journey, which disrespects a lot of the traditions that your club has. But for me, looking at this looking at the PR and comms around this, what's been really striking, and I think it's been across the whole six clubs and the whole 12 clubs actually, is just how silent the owners have been. You know, they've basically gone out there with this one sort of statement where Joel Glazer and I think the guy from Juventus have made a couple of comments. They've said, this is what we're going to do. And the clubs have just repeated that and not said anything. They've not spoken to their managers. They've not spoken to their players. They've not spoken to their fans. Obviously, it's caused a massive backlash, but what sort of damage do you think this does, Danny, going forward for all of these clubs?
A lot of these big clubs and these owners didn't have an amazing reputation anyway. Speaking as a Chelsea fan, I mean, people have always criticised Roman Abramovich for his yachts and his relationship with President Putin and Russian oligarchs. And it wasn't great anyway. But I do think in recent years, actually, Chelsea and Roman Abramovich have possibly improved their reputation a bit in terms of their investment in women's football and fighting racism and quite a lot of community initiatives. So perhaps the reputation was improving a little. I certainly think something like this sets the reputation back for both Roman Abramovich and indeed all of the billionaire owners of the big six clubs. The mistrust was there anyway. The mistrust has been further heightened. It's very difficult to see where they go from here. Having said that, I can't see any way a lot of these owners are going to be unseated from running these clubs. So perhaps we all need to come to a negotiated relationship with the owners of our beloved clubs. I mean, our clubs, your and mine, have been around for somewhere between 100 and 150 years. And these oligarchs have been around for 10 or 20. And life will go on beyond them, no doubt. So we have to find our peace with this current phase of football ownership.
I just think, I mean, from a Liverpool perspective, the fans really bought into John Henry and FSG and, you know, I would say the majority of fans really have appreciated what they've done for the club. But this was just, I mean, it felt like betrayal. It just felt like they were just, everything they stood for before was completely fake. And as soon as the opportunity came to grab some money and try and control the game, they went for it.
Well, perhaps is that a misunderstanding of what some of these owners are all about? Because it was always known that FSG was an American franchise owner, and perhaps that's the way they do business. They see sports clubs as being guaranteed franchise, guaranteed income opportunities, and they'll always be looking to protect their income from year to year. So perhaps, although they talk a good game in terms of respect and traditions, that is their way of doing business.
Maybe that was a bit of naivety on the part of Liverpool fans.
Yeah, maybe it was. I think football fans' naivety is an admirable quality. I mean, we all love our clubs and they all mean so much to us, don't they, from our childhoods and our families and so on. And I don't think we can be criticised for being naive. We want the best for our clubs. We love the players. We love the managers who do well. And you know, we must be more cynical, I think, about these owners, because if they really are only in it for the money and for making a quick buck over the next 5 or 10 years, then it's not looking good for the future of these great teams.
That's right. Given the crisis, I mean, there has been some winners and losers of this. I mean, the losers obviously are the club owners. They've had to climb down in a really embarrassing fashion. But there have been some really strong voices and people who stood up. And I think it's worth mentioning some of those. Gary Neville, for me, is definitely one of them. But, you know, even if you look at some of the players, you know, James Milner, he came out and pretty much dismissed it. And later Liverpool players did. You know, there's examples with Manchester United where Bruno Fernandes also did the same thing. Who for you, if we look at the way this, I know it's a very, very fast-moving thing, if we look at the way this has evolved, who has really shone out as being such an effective communicator/campaigner that's really influenced change?
I agree that a lot of the players who have spoken out have spoken very well, and I think we underestimate footballers' ability to sense the mood of the nation and to understand the values of the sport. And of course, last year we had Marcus Rashford and the brilliant work he did for feeding poor kids. And, you know, Jordan Henderson at your own club has done an amazing job in terms of taking an ethical lead. Harry Kane at Spurs last year did a lot of good work. So perhaps we're just starting to understand that footballers, despite the fact they've got generally quite a poor reputation because of all the scandals and gossip over recent years, that, you know, they do care. And I think all of the names you mentioned have done very well. I do think Gary Neville's become a very powerful voice for football. Sometimes he's a bit compromised between his love for Manchester United and his slight dislike of Liverpool. Yeah, his desire to sort of unite the football family. You kind of can't have it both ways. And therefore, he had that bit of falling out with Jurgen Klopp, which was kind of amusing. So nobody's perfect, are they? And it's easy to take a moral high ground, perhaps for some people rather than others. But I think players and fans have come out so much better than the owners,
which is really really positive, isn't it? When you look forward, and one of the things that you know this illustrates to me is that fan power actually does matter. You know, maybe 2 days ago I was like, oh God. Can this actually happen? Can they actually get away with this? But actually, no, they can't. And I think that's a really positive thing going forward.
Yeah, it is. And you make the comparison with America, don't you, where the NFL is this franchise model, a bit like the Super League was planning to be. And the American supporters just accept that. I guess it's always been like that. But that's clearly now, that whole model without relegation is unacceptable to the UK and possibly to European football fans as well. And that's very reassuring to me as a traditionalist.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I come from a country where we have, sports like the NRL, which is Australian Rugby League, and the AFL, which have a similar sort of franchise model, but they're very much closed environments. There's no opportunity for relegation and promotion. You can't apply that to a global sport like football. And the idea that you can get some American guys come in here and say, well, actually, we want it to be just like the NFL, for me, it's just... Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's a misunderstanding of what football is, as you say. And it's such a universal sport, isn't it, that if you are going to have a Super League, you have to have representatives from every part of Europe, from every part of the UK, and it's just not going to happen.
Not the elite few clubs from three countries. I mean, that's not even a European sport, is it, really?
No. Although, you know, I think what is interesting is, though fan power has... been really impressive, what happens next? Because I don't think a lot of the problems have been solved. I do think that the big clubs are now big businesses, and they need to be big businesses if they're going to carry on attracting the best managers and the best players. How do they work out their business models so they know how they're going to generate that much income to fund a lot of those purchases? And indeed, a lot of clubs are in debt. Even the big successful clubs are highly in debt. So something's got to change, I think.
Yeah. I mean, what this does is expose some of the broader issues that currently occur in football. It doesn't really provide many answers. It solves one really poor idea. But yeah, there are many big issues that still need to be resolved. And I guess we'll see how they pan out.
We will. It's going to be continuing to a fascinating year in sports as well as politics and business.
That is all we have time for today. I'd like to thank Danny and John and our producer, Lindsay Riley from Rethink Audio. If you enjoy this podcast, please do visit prweek.com/UK to stay up to date with all of our news and analysis, and would also love to hear your feedback on the PR Weekly. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, goodbye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.